welcome to another episode of Khaki Malarkey. Today we've got a bit of early modern history for you, and we'll be talking to the wonderful Catherine Fletcher about her book on the Italian Renaissance, The Beauty and the Terror.
So we'll kick things off then with our classic Khaki Malarkey question. Can you summarise your wonderful book, Beauty and the Terror, in 30 seconds?
Oh, ready gosh. Yes. Well, okay. So the book starts in 1492, and it's four stories about the 16th century that generally get told all in separate books. So it is one story about the Italian Wars, which is a brutal kind of pan-European conflict that mainly takes place on the Italian peninsula. It's one story about the art of the period. So that's people like Leonardo da Vinci, Michelangelo, all those kind of star names. It's one story about religious conflict, so that's your Reformation, Counter-Reformation, Catholic Reform. And it's one story, going back to 1492, about Columbus and European voyagers, colonizers, etc., going out and starting to conquer the world. And I put them all together into one book instead of leaving them in four, which is possibly quite a lot of work for me. But interesting.
Came in at 45 seconds there, but it was a good 45 seconds.
Okay, fair enough. There's a lot in there.
Very good description.
I'm excited.
I agree. It is a fantastic book, and it's absolutely brilliant. But what really, as you said, you know, you're combining four subjects into kind of one book. So what made you want to, first of all, combine it all? Because like you said, it's a massive task, but particularly like the terror side to it, because you know, we always think of the Renaissance as this wonderful rebirth and so magnificent and glorifying, but really you're really showing the opposite end of this.
Yeah, I guess I've written a couple of previous books on a much smaller scale that fit into this period of history, and so one of them was about Henry VIII's divorce, but looking at it really from the papal court in Rome and what the popes were thinking about it all, and the war kept turning up in the back of that. And then I wrote another book about Alessandro de' Medici, who is ruler of Florence in the 1530, whose mother is possibly a former enslaved woman, possibly African, we think he's mixed race. And again, the war kept turning up in the backdrop of that. And there wasn't really a book that explained it in a kind of lively way as an introduction for people. And I sort of put it to my publisher that it might be interesting to do that. And then we came up with this idea of, you know, perhaps telling the whole story together and explaining all the connections.
And then here we are with the book.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Were there any like challenges when you were kind of putting together such, you know, encompassing all these histories together?
I mean, sometimes it was what to put in and what to leave out. So yeah, you have to have, I think, enough of the kind of the well-known people, your Michelangelos and Machiavellis and so forth, so that people who are familiar with those already know where they belong in the story, but also didn't want it all to be the great men. So I wanted to make sure that there were, you know, some like ordinary soldiers involved in the conflicts, there were people who were being besieged, and then there were some of the women who just have much less profile as artists and writers and so on, even though, you know, they were there at the same time as the men that we know better.
So definitely from reading it, you did that perfectly.
Thank you.
I mean, I'm glad you said to kind of use the phrase men know better, and you mentioned it briefly a minute ago about how there's war in the background kept kind of cropping up. Obviously we are a military history podcast, we want to know about what conflict was going on at the time. So how did that context kind of shape your work? What were the big developments or wars that were going on in the period?
So the major conflict, I guess, on the Italian peninsula is between France and Spain. Spain, which is really quite a new state at this time, formed through the mergers of Castile and Aragon, and then their conquest of the Kingdom of Granada in their south. So from 1494 onwards, this sort of newly consolidated Spain and King of France are fighting over ancient claims to the Kingdom of Naples, and then also over for power and influence in northern Italy. Italy is one of the richest places in Europe, very, very wealthy, crossroads of the Mediterranean, really important for trade, really important strategically, and divided up into all these little states that are often in conflict with one another. So it's France and Spain fighting, but often fighting kind of by proxy with Swiss mercenaries, sometimes with imperial troops as well, so from the Holy Roman Empire, and in alliances with all these different princes and popes that have got their territories within the peninsula itself. So it's a very, very complicated back and forth set of wars. It's a very interesting set of wars for the development of a couple of key pieces of military technology, particularly handguns. Handguns really come into their own from as a battlefield technology in this set of conflicts. So in 1503, we have the Battle of Cerignola, which is takes place in the Kingdom of Naples. It's probably the first battle where the fact of one side really getting on top of using handguns and the other not is a decisive factor. So the Spanish basically sort of dig themselves in behind earthworks where the French cavalry arrive, their horses all fall into the ditches and the Spanish shoot them up. It's not very pretty. There's just a couple of thousand French troops dead within the hour. And wow. I mean, the tactical piece of brilliance on the part of the Spanish commander, even if it isn't very nice for the French. And so that happens. And then there's also a kind of the French very innovative early on in terms of development of artillery. And then there's a bit of an arms race to put up defences. So those star-shaped forts that you get that are known as the Trace Italienne, they really, again, come into their own in this series of conflicts as a way to protect your fortifications from these new improved siege cannons. So all sorts of stuff going on that military front as well.
I was going to say, it's quite a complicated picture in that time as well. So it must have been a lot to pull together over such a long period of time. Like, how many years is it exactly? But there is a lot of conflicts for a relatively small period of time. So
yeah, that whole series of Italian wars starts in 1494. The major land wars are done by about 1529, 30. But they sort of drag on until 1559 is the final treaty. So it's pretty much 65 years of on-off war. It's a big set of back and forth conflicts. Yeah, absolutely. And you imagine that there are people who are, you know, have no memory of there ever being a period on the peninsula when there isn't some kind of war going on, which is like, you know, that's taken up your whole life. Yeah.
And I'm always really interested in the kind of social side of war. And have you done research into how those wars affected the way that just regular people would live at the time? Like, what was their situation in relation to the conflict?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the conflict is interesting because it's kind of part-time and seasonal. So they don't tend to fight in the winter because climate doesn't work for it. Yes, so it's very much summer seasonal fighting. So you have a lot of soldiers who might like sign up for a season to fight to try and make some money, to try and get some booty. If they one of the issues that soldiers are meant to get paid, but often there's not enough ready cash to pay them. And the way they kind of settle those sort of disputes between soldiers and commanders over are we getting paid or not, is to say, look, we can't pay you, but we can give you the license to go and loot a city. So on the one hand, it's a way for soldiers to make money, but you can imagine it's not very nice, to
very
say the least.
From a disciplinary perspective as well.
The whole practice
of people later on, and like discipline and crime and punishment within the kind of red coats and later. So it's interesting to think of commanders balancing out pay with, you can just go and loot that village, and that'll make
It's quite that, like, you know, there's really interesting research been done on the Spanish army in this period where they think that actually the mutinies are often quite sort of structured in the sense that it's almost like there's a little bit of a routine and performance to it where the commanders know they haven't quite got enough money to pay them and they hold off until they really come and complain about it, and then soldiers sort of elect some representatives to go and complain, and the commander's like, all right, okay, we will sort of find a way of getting you some money now. So it's a really interesting sort of back and forth in this period before, because we haven't really got to a period of permanent standing armies yet. What you do get through the 16th century, you get more and more development of civic militias, so regular militia service where there's a kind of obligation on towns and villages in the different states to drill and so forth. You start to get, you know, you get the beginnings of it, but we haven't really got to the point where there's the regular sort of national
just kind of army. Starting to change the social structure a little bit, but
so we're getting that. But obviously for, you know, soldiers, basically, when they're moving through Italy, they're kind of living off the land. And so they, you know, that they will just help themselves to what supplies they can find locally. And if you're the locals, you there hand over what you've got or see if you can extract some money for it if you're lucky. And there is some, and you know, there is an element of sort of scorched earth policy. So that's an issue too. With the guns as well, a lot of problems of gun control, because you've got all these surplus military weapons then floating around in society. So there's an awful lot of like anxiety about how we're going to regulate those. You know, you where rules about where you're allowed to carry a gun and where you're not allowed to carry a gun. So all these sort of, you know, issues of being in what, you know, these days we would call a post-conflict environment start to kind of turn up. And you don't normally talk about, you know, Renaissance Italy as being a conflict environment or a post-conflict environment, but actually that a lot of the time that's exactly why absolutely what it is. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, it's so interesting.
No, it is fascinating, yeah.
So there was one element of the book that I found really interesting, and it was the War of the Words chapter, especially how you kind of said that it impacted women. So what can you kind of tell us about that?
I suppose, like, one of the things about, I mean, all sorts of wars is that there's a particular impact on women because men are so often away at war or responsible for doing things to do with the war economy, which means that gender roles get somewhat shifted. So you could think about a lot of aristocratic women in this period have, you know, their husband might be away leading troops on his own behalf or leading troops while the larger states. That's what a lot of the small kind of princes and dukes and so on in Italy do. They kind of enter the service of one of the big states and fight kind of in alliance with them, and for a fee coming back to them in the condottieri system. So they're basically like hiring themselves out as mercenary providers. And what they so what they do is the wives are left in charge of running everything, running the government of the state, running the castles, running the, you know, having to deal with all the bureaucracy, all the officials at court, you know, pretty much everything. And so that means that they're in fact doing a lot of the role that a male ruler would normally do. And you get that on the big level, and you get on a small level as well. You know, when men of any kind of social rank have gone off to war, it's the wife, or sometimes the mother or the sister or whoever who's left in charge at home. So it's you get this shift in gender dynamics. And I think that's one of the interesting things is to kind of consider how that feeds into the cultural world of the period, because it's a very one of the prominent examples of a woman in the literary world is Vittoria Colonna, whose husband is a prominent military commander. She's widowed. She writes a lot about that kind of experience of being widowed and of her sadness at her husband's absence and so forth. And I think that, you know, I do wonder whether in that kind of period of warfare, which is also a period of kind of religious change and turbulence because of the impact of the Reformation coming in, you know, there is a sense of perhaps a little bit of shake up of social roles and people not being quite sure what the rules are anymore, and experimentation. And I mean, there's certainly through that first half of the 16th century, it's a big flourishing of women writers, not just Colonna, but Veronica Gambara, there's Tullia d'Aragona, there's a whole sort of list of women. And by the 1550s, you have
amazing
names, you know, these kind of, yeah, these collect this sort of collection of, I mean, you know, 50 odd women poets being published, which is extraordinary. You know, it's not, you know, we've never heard of these people, very few of them outside the kind of fairly narrow academic world, but you know, there's an awful lot of them about and writing on all sorts of subjects, sometimes writing on military affairs, sometimes writing about peace, sometimes writing about education. I mean, there's a whole kind of, you know, range of topics.
Well, it's really nice to think that especially at a time where society doesn't allow women maybe to have a voice, that here they were making their voices and they were being heard. And it wasn't just one off, as you hear typically, one significant woman. There was sounds like loads of them. And that's just brilliant. I think, do you reckon there's more study in depth to go into this kind of topic, like to explore these voices of these women?
This is certainly, we're getting a few more of them just over the past few years. We've got more of the work that's translated into English now. So we've got a few different collections. We've got a big new collection of The Letters of Isabella d'Este, who's a Marchioness of Mantua, a very prominent art patron and collector. Got a new collection called Corresponding Renaissance, which is letters written by Italian women. Got a few more now, just making it a little bit more accessible to people who don't speak Italian, because of course that for a long time, you know, these collections are out there, but there's no translations of them. So, you know, unless you had the language, you're a bit stuck. And now it's nicer because, you know, in universities and so on, we're able to teach more of this material. And, you know, students who aren't as expert in the language or know a little bit but haven't got the sophistication to read the poetry, for example, which is, you know, a tough going even for me, because, you know, what poetic language is like in English. I mean, you know, you try to do it in a different language, it's even trickier again. So I think that will make a difference to the kind of wider appreciation of some of these people.
Oh, how did you find the kind of research process? I'm interested in the kind of sources you talk about. Letters, and they're some of my favorite sources to work with. I think they're so personal, and they're so I just love reading them. So what did you use? What was your kind of favorite part of researching for the book?
Oh gosh. So this book, because this book brings together things that I've been writing about for, you know, a decade and a half, it's like the research was kind of a bit chaotic, because there were lots of things that I'd sort of noticed in the past and I knew was out there. And I was kind of then bringing back in. So, yeah.
Well, so there are
letters. Yeah. So there are kind of things. There are letters. There's poetry. There are military memoirs from some of the people who wrote. There are these kind of little the biographies of the period. So biography starts to be a kind of collective biography starts to be a thing in the 16th century. So you get Vasari's Lives of the Artist, which is extremely partisan source, in which the Florentine artists are all obviously the best. And then you get things like there's sort of a collection of notable men and women, which is like interesting. Like there's a whole description of this one. You know, there's one woman, I think this is Colonna, she's a, you know, great poetess, and then there's this whole description of her breasts by the man. massive. So women authors' problems through the ages, I think this is kind of like some
why have men not changed?
But all sorts of things, down to lists of, you know, military muster lists and so on, of who in which town has got which weapons.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Ooh, so, sounds amazing.
Yeah. What got you into history then?
Yeah.
Oh, I had a long gap when I wasn't very into history at all. And I didn't do it at school beyond what was compulsory. So I didn't do your kind of, I was in Scotland, so it would have been then O grades or standard grades, but that's your sort of, so dropped it before you got to kind of GCSE level. And came back to it sort of in my 20s, when I was really off the back of going on holiday to Florence and getting into the Italian history and thinking, oh, this might be quite fun, and maybe not kind of thinking that I wanted to stay in the job that I had then necessarily in the long term, and maybe I would do something else, and perhaps that could be, I didn't quite know what, but I quite like the idea of being able to explore some of the Italian history a bit more. And so it was actually just going and starting to visit places, and that was at this point in the 90s, end of the 90s, beginning of the 2000s, when cheap flights had just come in. And I think before that it was much less accessible, because you would have to pay your full kind of, you know, British Airways type fare able to go to Italy. And then we had like EasyJet Start and Ryanair, and the British Airways had a cheap bit for a little while, and so it made getting around the European cities much more feasible.
Oh, God bless Ryanair, honestly. I got to Rome for £12 return once, and I'll always think that was one of the best bargains I got.
Absolutely.
So how did you get from that then to producing your work to where you are now?
So basically, having done a little bit of exploring and did a kind of evening class on Renaissance history, I decided that I was going to have a proper shot at doing an MA. So I did an MA part-time while I was working. I worked in the BBC political unit. So I was doing kind of journalism and writing and making captions for TV coverage of Parliament and showing politicians around places. So that's partly where I got some of my interest in the sort of structures behind political life as well, observing what went on in Westminster, which kind of then became a bit of a theme in my research. And I did well enough in that that I got funding to do a PhD. So I went back, I basically took a career break, went back to university full time and did the PhD. And that was on the diplomacy, it was on how diplomacy worked, on the kind of daily practice of diplomacy. But my big case study was Henry VIII's divorce, because that was 6 years of divorce negotiations with the Pope. Wow. So trying to get divorced from Catherine of Aragon by the time between when it starts and when it finishes. So it's a huge amount of diplomacy and correspondence. Mm. So I went and studied that, and I wrote a book that, well, it was originally called Our Man in Rome, and then it was called The Divorce of Henry VIII, The Untold Story, because publishers do this thing of changing the titles. And I wrote that book, and then I sort of, and then I kind of went on and in the process managed eventually, after a very slow process, to get a permanent job in a university. And I sort of have gone on from there. And so, yeah, gradually sort of expanding the type of books that I write and focusing a little bit less on the Tudor side of things that I did initially and more on the Italian side of things.
Yeah. Oh,
well, I love it. Italy's my favourite country. So keep the books coming.
So are there any... That's Liz's absolute dream, just to retire to Rome.
It's lovely. Happening.
Yeah.
An incredible film. Yeah. I can envision it now. It'd be amazing. So in all of the history you studied, there's a lot of different things you talked about. Are there any historical myths that you would like to bust? Another one of our kind of classic questions here.
Oh,
you know, everyone seems to have one.
Well, actually, I mean, this goes back to the stuff about Henry VIII's divorce, because a lot of people think that the Pope at the time didn't give Henry his divorce on some kind of Catholic principle. And it's absolutely nothing to do with any Catholic principles at all, because they were perfectly open to sort of annulling marriages on a piece of technicality if it suited them politically. I mean, they definitely did that.
Of course.
It wouldn't have been a problem. The problem is all about politics, all about war. And it's about the fact that at the time, Catherine of Aragon's nephew, Charles V, the Holy Roman Emperor, had a bunch of troops in Italy, had the upper hand in the Italian wars, and was in a position to help the Pope's nephew get back into power in Florence. So it's all about big picture geopolitics, warfare, and it's not about whether or not divorce is the correct religious thing to do. A lot of people think, you know, well, the Pope was Catholic, so he said no, and then Henry left the Church of Rome in order to get a divorce on principle. But it's really like, if the Pope had felt politically inclined to do it, they would have found some paperwork that, you know, was wrong. They could have all have agreed to it, but no, didn't happen.
I think it's annoying when the story gets painted as some grand love gesture that Henry literally created an entire church and broke from Rome purely for Anne Boleyn. And it's quite ridiculous when you just put it like that, isn't it? So I'm glad that you've chosen that for your history.
Definitely. So of your wonderful career that you've had so far, and I'm sure there's going to be lots more to come, what has been the best moment for you so far within it all?
Oh, like, this is a really, really tough one. There is one fabulous moment that I'm not allowed to talk about in public yet. So I'm going to have to keep you on secret tenterhooks with that. Oh. However, I had to say, one of the really fun things that I've done recently was going to Florence and filming The Fresh Guide to Florence with Fab Five Freddy. Not just because this gave me a quantity of street cred with all my much cooler friends who like understand hip hop and so on. And they're like, you're filming in Florence with like the actual Fab Five Freddy? And I was like, yeah, he's kind of interested in art and stuff. And then we went round so I got to go to Florence and talk through the story of Alessandro de' Medici on location for that documentary, which was on BBC Two. And that was just really good fun getting to tell that story to a whole load of people who would not have come across it otherwise, and to a lot of people who probably wouldn't necessarily have watched a documentary about Florentine history were it not for Fab doing the kind of presenting in his own like unique way, which was really, really good fun.
Oh, that sounds fantastic. All you have to do is make history entertaining for others. It's possible, and what not fantastic opportunity for you.
Yeah, no.
I have to ask, what's your favorite place in Italy? Where would you like live? Liv would retire to Rome, was it?
Yeah.
Where would you get your Italian villa?
Oh, I absolutely love Rome. And I think, if I was going to live in one city, it would be Rome. But I've also done, I've been around a lot of gorgeous little towns. And most recently, I've been doing quite a bit of research in Brescia, which is up near the mountains. And that's a beautiful city. Just really not very touristy. It feels like you're sort of properly in Italy and you're not constantly avoiding pickpockets or like trying to get out of the way of like large tour parties, like taking up the streets.
Oh, amazing. So
right.
So we'll go into our quick fire, our fun round then to finish up here. It's been so nice talking to you about kind of Italian history. We haven't had some early modern history on here for a while, so it's been refreshing to talk about something a bit different. It's just lovely. So we're going to ask you four questions and we want your immediate answer to it. Okay, the first one is, who is your favourite figure in all of history?
Oh, I keep changing these, but currently I'm a huge fan of a woman called Marianna Stark, who wrote one of the first guidebooks to Italy on how to do the grand tour. Actually got caught up in the Napoleonic Wars in the process and had to stop.
As
you do. And she's a guidebook is absolutely fantastic because not only does she give a very early version of star ratings to the stuff, like in form of exclamation marks, 5 exclamation marks for the Sistine Chapel, for example. But she also tells you which museums are cold and damp. And she's like, museum being damp, not really good practice.
Groundbreaking.
Take a warm coat for this museum, it's cold.
Oh, I like that. Bless her. So what did she go around all of Italy?
She did about 7 years of traveling in Europe as a companion to somebody whose name we don't know on the grand tour. And then she wrote it up in a book, partly because she got caught in the Napoleonic Wars and she was an eyewitness to stuff that was going on. A book was a bestseller and it became a real model for a lot of the modern tour guides that came after in the 19th century. So she is really the kind of mother of the modern guidebook. And
incredible.
Anyway, she's going to be in my next book, which is all about traveling to Rome. So it's been a couple of years to go on that. Yeah, but yeah.
I can't wait to tell my mum that my mum's like the queen of guidebooks. Everywhere she goes, she has to go and buy a guidebook before. Like even in 2021.
You can get it on Google Books. If you just look up Marianna Stark on Google Books, you can read the original for yourself. You download your original version.
Mum, if you're listening, get on it.
Stuff has got like all the exclamation marks in it.
Oh, I love it. Right, let's flip that question round then. Moving forward, who is your least favourite figure in all of history? Which I think is a considerably harder question.
It is a really hard question. I don't know if I'm allowed. Am I allowed to have a collective answer? Because I think it's quite easy. I think it's quite easy to like pick out the big, your kind of great villains of history, like Hitler or Pol Pot. But actually, in some ways, it's not so much them. It's the people who sort of stood around and watched what they were doing and didn't try to stop them. Mm-hmm. So it's the kind of the people who were like the bystanders to evil. Yeah. Not so much the bad guys themselves, because I reckon they're always going to be bad people, out there who wants to do terrible things, but they can be stopped.
Yeah,
I suppose by frustration.
I think that's a good answer.
Good answer. Yeah. Don't God, we've them. Had some good answers for this round lately, Liv.
We have.
We have to make this really one a bit harder. So now, this question is about, it involves our magic time traveling band, where you can pick 3 figures from any period in history. from that description. If you could pick 3 people to go on a road trip with, who would you have in your car?
Oh, right. So for my own period of history, I definitely want Lucrezia Borgia to come on my road trip, because I just really want to know like what it was like to be that woman with that reputation at the time. And I want to know all the stories about, she had a mozzarella factory. I also think she'd bring some fantastic cheese board and snacks. Artisan cheese and wine. So I think I would like trust her to like look after some good catering. and then I also want to have Alexandre Dumas, who also wrote, French writer of the 19th century. He also wrote about Alessandro de' Medici, And I would love to talk to him about being somebody else who wrote a play and a novel about Alessandro de' Medici, and I would love to like hear his views on Alessandro's life. And then I would also have the American satirical writer Dorothy Parker, just for the one-liners. She's like the absolute queen of stinging one-liners put downs, which I think is the sort of thing you want from a traveling companion.
Definitely. It's a great car. Have some great conversations on that road trip. Yeah, the conversation would be flowing. Right, final question then. If you could go back in time for one day, where and when would you go?
I think like definitely to Rome. And I think definitely to one of the massive like festival days that they have. Like, you know, when the Borgias were in charge of the papacy, they used to have like bullfights in the Piazza Navona. And
oh my God,
I think that would
you
be
imagine
quite,
that?
Yeah. It was quite like spectacular. So I do think, yeah, I would like to go and see one of those mega Renaissance festivals.
Yeah, that would be
happening
cool.
In practice.
Agreed.
Possibly one of the ones where they put wine in the fountains.
Yes, that would be pretty
like
fun.
Fun festival. Yeah, that sounds big. Great answer. Well, it's been so lovely having you on, Catherine. Thank you so much for talking to us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
We really appreciate it.
Yeah, it's been so much fun. I hope you've enjoyed it. And like I said, thank you for giving up your time and this Thursday evening where it's a little bit sunny outside. So
yeah. No, you're very welcome.
And that was the wonderful Catherine Fletcher talking to us about her book, The Beauty and the Terror. Now, here's a little preview of what we've got up for next week.
Men who served in the ranks very often go back into civil society, and they won't necessarily talk about their war service because it's not seen as having the same status as combatant service. It's not that they won't talk about it, they're not necessarily ashamed of it, but it just it's not a story that gets told a great deal in the interwar period. So there's a much more ambiguous picture that I point to in my book, that that these men do in some ways have good wars, but they're not necessarily the types of wars that they will be proud of or that they will boast about.
And in the meantime, don't forget to like, follow, retweet everything on Twitter, engage with us, please. And also, if you can, give us a review, rate us. Apparently that helps with algorithms and stuff as well. We'd really appreciate it. In the meantime, I'm Olivia Smith.
And I'm Phoebe Stone.
And this is Carter signing off.